Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Folks, if you haven't done so, remember to subscribe to the podcast in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the SQPN YouTube channel, where you should also hit the bell to get notifications. So, Melanie, we did not win the $1 billion lottery this week.
I didn't expect that we would.
It would have been a very different podcast if we had.
Would we even be doing a podcast if we had?
We'd have to maintain our cover that we hadn't won until we were ready to reveal to the world.
So really, if we had won, we would still be saying that we hadn't won because we wouldn't want anyone to know we had won.
I wouldn't lie. I just wouldn't mention it.
Right.
Because you don't have to tell anyone. But this is this. So clearly, we didn't win. I wouldn't lie about it.
Right.
So we're not secretly. Well, also, I didn't travel to Minnesota or Michigan. I forget where. One of those Midwest states that where it was the winning ticket was sold. Could you imagine $1 billion, baby. That is a lot of money. I just cannot even comprehend.
I mean, on the one hand, it would be kind of nice not to be in debt and to be able to, you know, do things. But I think that's almost too much money. Like, I don't know if I want the burden of that kind of wealth.
I did a little math, right? If you take the lump sum and after taxes and all that sort of stuff, you end up basically with a chunk of, I think it was $428 million chunk. Boom, here's a check. Say you invest it, you spend a little, say you have $400 million left, you give away $28 million. You invest it and you take annually 4% out of your income. So
okay,
you should get maybe at least 10%. A decent, you know, investment manager could get 8 to 10% out of it. You want it to grow, so you take 4% out. That's still what did I say, 400 million, 10% is 40 million, so 4% is about $18 million a year. That's still...
That's crazy money.
That's crazy money.
That's more money than any human being needs to make in a year.
Unless you want a house shaped like the Millennium Falcon.
No, I do not want that.
Unless you want to have your own plane. Like, it's crazy money. That's the kind of... Anyway, we didn't win, so no sense talking about it now. If I had one, I would be totally giving money to all of the Catholic media apostolates that I know.
Yeah,
we'd be going bank gangbusters. That would have been awesome.
That would be nice.
Yeah. Anyway, that's not what we did.
We could just give SQPN content away for free without having to actually have any subscribers or patrons or anything.
I mean, I love the fact that people can support us and that it's a way of them participating in what we do.
Yeah.
But gosh, it would be awesome to, you know, just hire editors and pay the podcasters. Nobody gets paid. This is all volunteer. All the SQPN podcasts. I mean, it would just, yeah, never mind. That's all neither here nor there. Anyway, let's talk about what we actually did, which is you we just announced it, which I kind of, in retrospect, we should have told people that they could have done this. But
we should have. And I don't, it's just slipped my mind.
Yeah, it's, we're not in the mindset of telling people. Well, what did we, well, now we have to tell instead of talking about it in the abstract.
In a roundabout way.
You gave a talk at an online, that's because all things are online now, an online conference this past weekend.
Yes. My friend Jen Fitz and Sherry and
Antonetti.
I cannot say Antonetti. I'm very sorry, Sherry. Antonetti hosted a conference this weekend called the Good Discourse Conference. And really, it's about Catholics, especially Catholic writers, who want to step away from bad discourse, from getting into fights, from nastiness, and the sorts of things that turn people away from the church. This is obviously really timely, and it's something I feel passionate about, like people communicating with love and with good rhetoric and
getting away from polemics and the cancel culture and social media of destruction and all that sort of stuff.
Exactly. I didn't get a chance to hear all of the talks. There were some this afternoon that I was not able to listen to, but the ones I did hear were all really excellent. And
it started Friday night?
Started Friday night, and there were two talks on Friday night. Then there were several on Saturday morning, including mine. And then I think there were two more this afternoon.
Okay. And so you told me I wasn't able to take part because while you were
You were holding down the fort.
Holding down the fort, keeping the house from being burned down by children.
Yes.
But so you told me that the first night, Friday night, there was a good talk by a priest.
Yeah. Father, I want to say John Lococo, who talked sort of generally about being a Catholic, being a writer, being a public witness. His talk kind of ranged all over the place, but it was really just excellent. I walked away just feeling really uplifted and also convicted in the way that a really good homily like does. And then I'm trying to remember who the other talk was and I'm blanking. Okay. Dr. Eric Lemieux, okay. Who talked about
Yes.
Oh, no, my mind. It's like Swiss cheese. I'm very sorry. He talked about the four cardinal virtues, prudence, temperance, fortitude, and...
Oh, you're quizzing me?
Yes, I'm quizzing you. Because like I said...
Fortitude, temperance...
Justice.
Justice. I was just about to say that.
And what they have to do with...
With the good discourse?
With good discourse. Well, there was like an overarching topic that he had broken down into the four temporal virtues.
Okay.
Giving fraternal correction, of course. He talked about giving fraternal correction in terms of the four cardinal virtues. And then the second part of his talk was really good, too, was receiving fraternal correction. And the structure that he used for that was, interestingly enough, a medieval manual on dying well. And so he talked about the five temptations of being on, you know, that face a person on their deathbed. He said, curiously, that it was a manual that was written during time of pandemic. And so seems kind of appropriate. But like the idea that receiving correction is a kind of death, like a spiritual death, like it's really hard. And so looking at the temptations that face a dying person in terms of how we kind of die inside when we receive spiritual correction, which is a really good way to end thinking about fraternal correction, because you have to remember when the occasion calls for you to give fraternal correction, that the person you're giving it to is experiencing a little death. So that has to be a part of how you approach them and how you address them, that it's done in love and it's done, you know, in prudence and in justice and in temperance and with fortitude, but that you also have to sort of put yourself in their shoes as well.
Okay. And then, so on Saturday morning, you gave your talk.
I did. I gave a talk about humility. There were two of us who talked about humility. There's also this beautiful woman from Milwaukee, Grace Urbanski, her talk was wonderful. She talked about humility in terms of contemplation of God's glory. And that the first step of humility is contemplating God in his glory. I really love that. I'd never really thought about our virtue in terms of contemplating, you know, we find our true humility when we first look at how amazing God is. But my talk was about humility in terms of, well, I sort of contemplated three of my favorite poems. And it seems like a kind of weird way to approach the topic of humility.
Through poems, you mean?
Through poems.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not generally how these kinds of talks are organized. But a speaker who talked earlier, before I did on Saturday morning, David Mills, talked about how a huge part of good discourse is knowing what kind of things you are called to write. You know, what box are you in? And then, you know, not trying to work outside your box, not scattering your seed all over the place, so to speak. And so as I was contemplating humility and the topic of humility, these poems just kind of kept tapping me on the shoulder, so to speak. Yeah. And so I decided, well, really, in all humility, what I am good at is, well, talking about literature, talking about poetry. That's what my passion is. That's what lights me on fire. And so that's, I went with it. It was, felt a little bit risky because I wasn't sure that anybody actually cares about poetry as much as I do. But I got a really great response. So I talked about Seamus Heaney's poem Digging, which is a poem about the poetic vocation. And then I talked about Emily Dickinson's I'm Nobody, which is one of my favorites from childhood.
Humility.
Yeah. I'm Nobody. And then I ended with the Magnificat, which a lot of people don't think in terms of, like,
as a poem.
As a poem. It's a prayer. It's a song. But I really liked it as poetry. And then I ended with, well, the Magnificat led me to the life of Blessed Charles de Foucault, whose vocation was to live the hidden life of Nazareth. And so I thought that, you know, Mary of Nazareth, Blessed Charles, It worked.
Right.
It was really fun. I really enjoyed the experience of getting to organize and give a formal talk. I don't think I've done that in a long time.
And if someone wanted to experience your talk?
I don't know that. I think that they made a recording. It's not yet available to me, and I'm not 100% sure that, like, it actually happened, but I'll get back to you on that.
But are you going to make it available online in some form?
I am. I do have plans to at least put the written form of my talk on my blog, hopefully this week. We'll see.
We'll see how that goes. We'll see how the week goes.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard good reviews. So Jen Fitz said to me that you rocked it. And that she was very glad that she tormented you into saying yes.
She didn't torment that much. She asked, and then she kind of, like, followed up once and kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, are you still interested?" And I said, "Yes, I am." That was really, yeah.
And then our friend Will Duquette also said that you rocked it. And he said, we were talking in a forum that we are all belong to online. And he said to me that that he's not a poetry person, but it's lovely to hear it discussed by someone who loves and understands it.
Yeah, Will and I have had some nice back and forth conversations on Facebook about poetry, because I post a lot of poetry on Facebook and on my blog, too. Mm-hmm. And Will has told me before, like, he's not really a poetry person, but every once in a while, something I post kind of grabs him, and he's like, "Hey, that's not so bad. Maybe there's something to this poetry stuff after all." And I love, one of my favorite things is when I can share something that means so much to me and light that, spark that fire of interest. Our friend Zena also said that before she met me, she didn't really like poetry. She thought she hated poetry, and she thought poetry was kind of, she wasn't smart enough to get it. And now she loves it, and she even writes poetry now. And she had a beautiful comment after my talk about, like, in terms of good discourse, like, she'd been having a argument with an atheist friend, and it just wasn't going well. And then she stepped back. She wrote down a poem and then gave it to them, and how that completely reframed the conversation. Hmm. It made her friends slow down, because poetry kind of it's a more experiential. Like, they had to slow down, ask her what she meant, and it really reframed the exchange. I love that. Oh, it's so exciting.
Yeah. I had a thought about poetry that just a second. There's something you often say about, like, it was when you relayed that Zena said, "Oh, she thought it was too hard." There's something you always talk about how poetry is taught, that there's a problem with the way people are taught poetry.
Oh, gosh. I think that, I mean, God bless all the high school teachers out there, because you have a really difficult job. And I think a lot of people teach poetry the way they were taught it. And this is something that Dana Gioia, who's a beautiful Catholic poet and who was the poet laureate of the United States a few years ago, I believe. Dana Gioia talks about the way that poetry was taught. Like, with modernist poetry, you get poetry that's suddenly really difficult, deliberately difficult, and then that requires a certain level of unpacking, pulling it apart in order to really understand what the poet's getting at. But that sort of became the default for how we read literature, is this process of analysis, of pulling it apart. It makes it, you know, difficult. And then we started applying that to everything. But
we dissect everything.
It's
like trying to appreciate a beautiful flower by pulling it apart and looking at all, you know, and taking apart the stem and the petals and all this other stuff, and then saying, well, this isn't that beautiful of a thing.
Right. I mean, it was like as if we expected people to do botany and pulling, you know, dissection of flowers, and told them that if they couldn't appreciate the beauty of it when it was all pulled to pieces, that, well, obviously they were too dumb to really appreciate the beauty of flowers. A flower.
Yeah.
But poetry is really, it's like flowers. It's an experience. I mean, every song ever written is really a poem, because lyric poetry's roots is song. That's what lyric means. Right. And song lyrics are the original poetry. And so they're like sort of moving away from poetry being sung to just being written on the page is really an artifact of the printing press.
Right. And one of the problems is the, as you've relayed to me, is this idea of what does it mean? Like, the teachers are always asking, well, what does it mean?
Right. Well, and then the worst is when the teacher has an idea in their head of what it means, and they make students feel like they're wrong if it means something, if it says something different to them.
Right.
But really, there's no wrong answer when it comes to poetry or to literature. Now, I would like to make a distinction as a literature teacher that it is perfectly legitimate to say, where in the text do you see that? Because sometimes students can like go off on these theories that really don't have anything to do with the actual words on the page.
Right.
But that's different from saying it, you're wrong, it doesn't mean that.
Or that you should find a particular meaning.
Oh, right. The Robert Frost stopping by woods at a snowy evening is really a poem about death. And if you don't like it, it's because, you know, you're wrong. Well, it's a poem about a guy who stops by woods on a snowy evening.
Right.
Now, can it speak to you of death? Sure. Does it necessarily, like, are you wrong if it doesn't speak to you about death? No. So, yeah, I mean, what I love about poetry is that it can speak to different people about different things.
Or books or movies or music and artwork, you know, the paintings. They can, you know, there is, all the meaning has to come out of the thing itself, you right? Like you're saying.
Right.
The meaning has to be in it originally. And this is what I learned when I was doing learning how to do biblical studies and biblical biblical analysis, is whatever meaning you're trying to find in, say, the biblical passage has to be in what's written there first.
Right.
You have to start at the textual level.
But I think sometimes we have this idea that, like, the author has to have intended every meaning, and that's not necessarily true, because I think that most art goes beyond the author themselves and partakes in something more universal.
The author's intent is important.
Right.
But it's not the end of it.
Right. It's not the end all be all, because the symbols themselves that the authors are using are themselves sort of exist outside of the author, like a tree or a cloud or the sun.
Or snow in the woods.
Right. Or snow in the woods or birds. Like, they speak to us because they're
universal.
They're external. They're universal. And so.
And they're objective, not subjective.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the poet's job is to sort of bring things that are unlike together, which is one of the reasons why poetry is such a good way to talk about good discourse, because good discourse is bringing the unlike together and making connections.
Right. And doing it in a way that isn't destructive, but is constructive.
Right. So a poet sort of creates a world and then invites you inside. But then how you experience that is going to be different for everybody who hears the poem or reads the poem. It's an experience, and it might be different every time you read it too. Like, I don't read I'm Nobody the same way in my 40s as I did when I was 10.
Right.
It feels like a very different poem, and yet it's the same words on the page. Like, I've changed, not the poem.
So if someone wanted to get started with dipping their toe into poetry on a regular basis, I'm going to suggest, as someone who is myself a non-poetry person, especially before we met, that they might check out a podcast called The Daily Poem.
It's so good. I love The Daily Poem podcast.
It's on all the various things. It's from the Close Reads podcast network. So if you're looking, if there's more than one that you find, that's the one you're looking for, is the Close Reads podcast network, The Daily Poem podcast. And
It's done by the Searcy Institute, which they're really, really have lots of great podcasts on the Close Reads Network. They read a bunch of different books, like very slow, like a chapter at a time, and, mm-hmm. and discuss it.
And right. And Close Reads is the way it's short. Every episode is like, what, 10 minutes.
The daily poem, you mean?
Yeah. The daily poem is less than 10 minutes. It's usually 5 or 6 minutes.
Usually he introduces the poet. He reads the poem and makes a couple of observations and then reads it again. And if it's like a really long poem, he might just read it twice. I say David Kern is the usual host, although sometimes he has various other guest hosts when he's away.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at their listing right now. They haven't had one since December. So
yeah, David and his wife, his family moved recently, and they also opened a bookstore recently, which I suspect has been taking more of his time than he anticipated.
I know how that works. Yeah. I've been on the other end of that. Okay, well, so daily, so check it out.
But they've got hundreds of poems like in their archives from the last several years, so there's plenty to listen to.
455 episodes, so it's a good way to get started in it. So one thing I want to mention, one thing that Jen said of your talk, she said, left to my own devices, I never would have spent that much time with poetry, which the sheer amount of time she spent on Dickinson was an education, in that towards the end of that segment, I had this aha moment about the poem that I would not have had in my usual haste to move on.
That's, I think, if poetry is at all difficult, it's difficult in that it requires time and attention. It requires focus. I myself have had a long journey in learning how to read poetry, and you can't really read a whole bunch of poems. Like, you don't read a book of poems by picking it up and just like reading it at the same pace that you would read a novel or something. Like, you read one poem and then you put the book away and you might not touch it again for like a week or a month, or at least not until tomorrow or later today. Like, they really need time. Mm-hmm. And I find that I understand poetry so much better if I try to read it out loud. Like, really, poetry wants to be heard. It wants to be spoken. It wants to be felt in the mouth and in the ears. It's not really just when it's words on a page, it's kind of dead.
The other thing is with poetry is it doesn't have to be highfalutin and all intellectual and very mysterious. It can be about it can be fun and funny and normal and about everyday things, whether it's Seamus Heaney. Or who is the woman who lives in Greece, the American woman?
Oh, A.A. Stallings. A.A. Stallings.
Yeah, A.A. Stallings. You read me a couple of her poems that were, I forget, there was one with like an ATM or something. Like, it was like, and it was funny. It was.
Oh, I love her Sestina Like, which is just sort of a riff on all the different ways that like is used, especially like the Facebook like. You can push like and oh, it's like so great. Like, it's hilarious.
Yeah, it's so. There are lots of different kinds of poems.
And
out
then
there.
Billy Collins is a great one for humorous.
Irish poets are the best for that sort of thing.
Actually, he's.
I thought Billy Collins was Irish.
No. He's American. He was an American poet laureate.
I think I mix him and Seamus Heaney up in my head at some times.
Yeah, that's okay.
So, but cool. So I'm going to guess this is not the last time we talk about poetry. Hopefully that is not a turn off. Hopefully we've piqued your interest about it. Because, again, I am not a poetry person normally, but I have come to appreciate and enjoy it. Not as much as you and Bella do, of course. I'm glad that you both enjoy it together. You are quite a pair when it comes to poetry. But I've come to appreciate it. And so hopefully it'll become part of the show going on forward. I did want to talk quickly about we had talked last week about the scouting. And how Ben and Sophie and Bella were all doing the Cooking Merit Badge. And one of the things about these merit badges is they require a lot of work from the scouts. Like, they have to make something like, you know, 15 different meals at some point using cooking at home, cooking in a camping situation, cooking in a hiking backpacking situation. And there's three of them.
That's a lot of meals.
That's a lot of meals. I forgot. Like this week they were all supposed to, like, the scoutmaster said, okay, now you guys have to go cook a meal this week. And it's like, oh, that's three meals. And
right.
And it's not always easy. And then we've got Lucy and Anthony's scouting stuff to manage too. I forgot, like, managing five kids in scouting, three of them at about the same level at the same place in scouting. That's a lot of work. I have to say, I'm a little, I'm sometimes a little overwhelmed by it, but it's
good, but it's, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing we've been talking about is there's a lot in scouting. It's about the push to Eagle, get to Eagle. You know, we're earning our merit badges. We're earning our ranks, we're getting to Eagle, but there has to be a place and there can be a place, but you have to make sure that the other adults you're working with recognize it for kids who aren't interested necessarily in ranking up.
Right.
They just want to be there. They just want to experience. They want to go to meetings. They want to go on hikes. They want to do stuff. They want to go camping. They want to be outdoors. There's got to be a place for them.
You know, it strikes me that this is a difficulty not only in scouting.
Oh, it's American.
But yeah, in a lot of kids' activities, like I would have loved the kids to take Irish dance classes. I've always kind of wished I had been able to take them. But you cannot find Irish dance classes that are not competitive. Even the schools that say, well, kids don't really have to compete.
There's still pressure.
The pressure is just sort of built into the way that those schools function. And I think that's kind of something is lost when we don't make space for kids to just experience things without needing to advance, compete, get so far into it. Like there should be more room for those thresholds of just I'm doing this for fun.
Well, not everything in life has to be competitive, but we've sort of made it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, life, getting by in life as an adult requires some competitive spirit in many things. Sure. But that's not everything. Like I'm completely against competition. I'm not a participation trophy sort of guy in that sense. I think there should be competition in some things, but there should be not everyone should be required to be competitive and not everything should be a giant competition. And so I agree with that. There's so many areas. And so this is one of them where, you know, at least one of our kids is not interested necessarily in doing the merit badges and getting, you know, they're interested in doing the work, but they're not interested in fulfilling requirements in order to get a rank so they can get up to Eagle.
Right.
The problem is that that scouting itself, like it's kind of a little bit inside baseball, but they have the scoring system for troops to determine how well they're doing based on all these criteria. And you want to earn your top badge. Like the badge has to earn an award every year for they're doing so well. You're doing so well. You've earned the J23 award. I forget what it is. And one of the metrics is the kids advancing.
Right.
And which
then puts pressure on the leaders to put pressure on the kids. And
right. But a good leader will say, you know what? I don't care about that stuff. It's what's important is you're here. You're enjoying yourself. You're getting something out of it.
Right.
So anyway, that's my little thing about scouting. The other thing that happened after dinner tonight, if it's not become clear yet, we're a very music oriented family. We love music.
Which is funny because like I am not musical.
Well, I can't play an instrument.
I
have a fine singing voice. I know.
Uh-huh. I do not sing well.
We sing among ourselves.
Yes.
We sing shanties. But anyway, after dinner, Sophie said something about where has Bella gone? You know, they were cleaning up and she was like, where has Bella gone? And you were triggered in your mind the lyric.
Where have all the flowers gone?
Where have all the flowers gone? Which you then tried to get the Echo to play for you. And it would insisted on playing Where Have All the Cowboys Gone, which is not nearly the same thing.
Not even in the same ballpark.
But that got us into listening to a bunch of the 60s and 70s hippie music that started playing. Because I eventually did get it playing in Apple Music. And then it started playing, you know, similar music. And for me and you, for both of us, like you were born in the 70s, but I was born in the late 60s. So this was the music that...
This is the music my mom
listened to. That my older sister listened to. Is a teenager. Your mom was not a teenager at the time, but she listened to the stuff. And I remember going on car trips and hearing this on the radio or on the 8-track in the camper. Did you know we had a VW camper, like a VW minibus?
No.
We totally had one of those. With the smiley face cover on the spare wheel on the front.
Wow.
The whole thing.
The whole nine yards.
It was, I mean, I was I was like four when we had that. It was, I was really young. I don't really remember it. I remember from pictures, but yeah. So
my parents had the VW Bugs. Mm-hmm. Though my mom's car when they got married was a Bug.
Yes.
And then she traded it in for another Bug eventually. So my sister actually inherited my mom's Bug and drove it for quite some time. My mom actually tried to teach me to drive on a Volkswagen Beetle.
Which was automatic. I mean, not an automatic.
It was manual. It was a manual and...
It was backwards somehow or something?
Oh, no. So what it was that the speedometer didn't actually work. So my mom shifted by listening to the engine.
No. The tachometer.
Yeah.
The tachometer shows the revs, and that's how you would know when to shift.
Neither that nor the speedometer.
Oh, the speedometer didn't work either.
No. Like she shifted according to the sound of the engine, and that was just between needing
the coordination required. I'm surprised your sister could drive it.
Well, my sister actually said that my sister's very ADHD, and she actually said that driving the Bug was better because it gave her hands and feet enough to do that. It kind of helped her to focus. For me, it was just too much, and I gave up. I learned how to drive on the minivan instead.
But we're not.
Oh, sorry.
We're not talking about cars. We were talking about music.
No, but this is actually what we were doing after dinner. Right. Is the music was leading to reminiscences, which the kids really like it when we talk about, like, what was the world like when you were younger? Sorts of discussions.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love that stuff with my parents too.
It's fun, and the music brings up memories that you wouldn't otherwise consciously remember.
Right.
And so what I find is that, you know, talking about movies or music or things like that, that is really what triggers sort of the cascade of memories. There was one song that ended up playing that totally took me back to high school.
The high school fight song?
Yes.
The night that...
The night they drove old Dixie down.
Yes.
I mean...
High school fight song.
Yeah, it was Austin, Texas.
It's a Texas thing, yeah. Yeah, I mean, some of the music, like whether it was the John Denver Rocky Mountain High or the Joan Baez, I forget what that one was, but the various songs, like, reminded me of car trips, you know, going up to, mostly our trips to Maine. Our vacations were always in Maine, and in a particular area of Maine where my mom's friends lived on a farm, I think I've mentioned before. But listening to this stuff always brings back those memories of being in these places, whether it's some of that old Beatles music or our trip that we took when I was 6 or 7 to Nova Scotia. You know, that music always brings back those memories of those places. And which is great because I have a terrible memory anyway.
Right.
So having the music really recall that. I mean, there is like 80s music, like certain Van Halen songs. When I hear them, I'm back in my bedroom in high school. You know, in sitting on my bed, I can tell you what book I was reading when I heard that song. Like, it's a very vivid memories. Yeah, I love and I loved being able to talk about that stuff with the kids. I mean, and this is the sort of stuff my dad did when we played his records, is Frank Sinatra and the Glenn Miller and all of that stuff. You know, so I love to listen to that music now, which is kind of funny because it's that connection with my parents.
Right, like. I mean, I was like, wow, I feel like listening to a whole bunch of, you know, Simon and Garfunkel and Bob Dylan and, you know, Beatles. It's just that music kind of takes you to the past.
It's funny how our parents are like slightly different generations.
Right.
Your parents are about 10 to 15 years behind my parents.
Right.
So, yeah, my parents are like definitely 40s and 50s music. Your parents are 60s and 70s music.
Right. My mom was born in the 40s, but her music is like 60s and 70s.
Yeah, she came of age in the 60s. Right. My mom was married in 50, like, you know, my mom and dad were married in 58, 59. So
whereas my parents were married in 67,
68, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Somewhere around when I was born. It's a lot of fun, and it's so awesome to have a service like Apple Music where all of the music is available at the touch of a button.
Right. And I wouldn't necessarily go out seeking to buy all of these albums if like Apple Music didn't exist.
Right. I held out for a long time on a music subscription service like this. I still wanted to buy my own music, but there came to a point where I realized it's really nice to just be able to have the entire breadth of music, millions of songs available.
I think that the resistance to a streaming service subscription totally dates us.
Yes, there is a certain age thing.
Because younger people like don't really know music outside of
right. I was showing the kids music. The box of 8-track tapes my mom gave me years ago. Like she's like, "Oh, you might want these." I don't want them. Like it's Lawrence Welk. Like I have no desire to. And all of the music I might want, like Stevie Wonder and stuff, it's I've got an Apple Music. But anyway, I brought the box up to show them the 8-tracks, and Bella was saying, "Yeah, when I'm your age." That this is CDs and DVDs are, you know, and Blu-rays are going to be like this stuff to me. I'm like, yep, everything from this point on is streaming. There is a bit of nostalgia factor, like records are actually big right now. They're selling more records now than CDs, which is interesting.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, there's a certain segment of people who want, like young people, who want to listen to records that analog sound, the needle on the plastic. The hiss, the pop, the whole thing. They want that. I mean, it seems weird to us who grew up with it, but we had similar weird stuff when we were younger. Like the whole martini phase. Remember that in the late 90s and the early 2000s?
I remember going to a martini bar in San Francisco.
Yep. It very much, you know, there was the whole 50s aesthetic.
Of course, I went to the martini bar because some friends dragged me. It was not something I would have sought out.
No, you would go to an Irish pub. I know. That's,
yeah. But martinis just really aren't my thing at all. No.
Yeah, I like a good martini. Anyway,
I really
But
don't.
You don't like gin, so that's
I
big.
I hate gin. I think I had a chocolate martini and it was okay. It was nothing to write home about.
Yeah, chick cocktails.
Yeah,
like apple teenies. Did I ever tell you about like when Paul, like my old roommate Paul, went to Chicago on business one time, and he got an apple teeny in a bar, and the bartender just looked at him weird, like I just want to try it, and I'm away from home. No one I know will see me. Anyway, so hey, share some music of your music with your kids, or if you do, you know, let us know. Is that a thing for you? You know, and what is it like? Do your kids like your music? Our kids like our music.
Mostly.
Yeah, Bella often tells me that she likes to listen to some of the playlists I've made in Apple Music because it reminds her of me and times that we've spent as family doing things. So I thought that was nice.
Yeah, I'm really terrible at playlists. Playlists are one of those things that I can't do. It's weird.
Well, I've had digital music. So here, mm-hmm. I'm the internet old guy telling you about, you know, how I've been doing this stuff forever. But my first digital music software was called SoundJam. It was the software created by Cassidy and Green Software in, I think, the late 90s. That was the foundation for iTunes. Like Apple bought SoundJam and turned it into iTunes. Like our iTunes library dates back over 20 years.
Wow.
The original. Like that library. I mean, I remember I won a Diamond Rio MP3 player in an online contest at some point. This pre iPod. It was like the MP3 player before the iPod.
I remember the Rio.
Yeah. Which was cool. You could put like a whole album on a little
card. A whole album
on a little card. I mean, yeah, it was kind of funny, but like a 16 megabyte SD card or something like that. But yeah, I mean, and so I love making playlists. You've seen my playlists.
I mean, I love the idea of playlists. I would love to have playlists, but somehow when it actually comes down to sitting in front of the computer with a bunch of songs in the library and trying to pick songs from the library and put them into a list, I get I get overload.
That's the thing is I don't do that. I hear a song and I'm like, I want to set that aside. Or there's a couple songs, I set them aside and then I build the list over time as I hear music.
But see, the thing is that I might set something aside. The building part, just my brain doesn't work that way. All I'm saying is, I don't know why. I would love to be able to do that.
Yep.
But somehow it never, it's broken.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
All right. Well, let's move on and talk about what we've been eating because we're well into the podcast here. One of the things I wanted to mention was So, it's speaking as an old guy, one of the things that's kind of funny is I watch, whether it's on the Instagram or on Facebook or on YouTube, these hacks, these amazing food hacks. Like, hey, here's this amazing thing I discovered. And I look at it going, well, duh, that's not really a hack. That's just how you should do it. Like, that's just the way of doing it. And I realize I'm 50 something years old. I've been doing this a long time. So I have experience. Young people do not have experience. Yeah, but this is new.
But you're constantly coming to me and telling me like this cool new trick that you found out about. It's just that they happen to be finding out about the cool new trick that you learned about 10 years ago.
Right.
Now.
Well,
but at one point it was a cool new trick to you too.
Right. Well, that's what I'm wanting to get to I found about this cool new trick. Well, it wasn't the trick. It was just sort of I heard someone say something else and it gave me an idea. And what it was is, so when you're making French fries or fried potatoes, one of the things you want to do is if you want to make French fries, you want Yukon Gold potatoes because they have a waxy, starchy texture, which when fried gives you that crunch. That's where you get that outside crunch from. And yet they stay soft in the middle. Okay. Well, one of the things I saw was if you want to really encourage them to be crunchy, you par cook them. And then you kind of bruise up the sides by shaking them in a bowl or something like that. And that breaks the starch on the outside of it. And I'm thinking, well, what if you put starch on the outside of it? Because we have a bag of potato starch that you know, it's among the various alternative flours that you've been using for making stuff for Lucy because of her allergies to regular flour.
Yeah, potato starch is great for thickening soups.
Oh, yes.
Especially any soup that has potatoes in it.
Exactly.
Because your potatoes, when they cook down, release the starch anyway. So it has the same sort of flavor and consistency.
Right. So I said, well, what if you put potato starch on the outside of, say, fries or home fries or oven fries, or any potato thing that you're trying to get a crunchy texture on?
So you did it on the cold oil fries.
Right. So if you remember, there's a recipe for making French fries where you put the cut up potatoes in a pot, cover them with cold oil, an inch over it, maybe, or just covered cold, turn it on medium high.
No, high.
High. And then let it cook for 15 to 20 minutes until
they're golden brown.
Right. But, and stir them so they don't stick together. But until they're golden brown, and then they're done. Like, there's no, double frying and all this other stuff, dumping in hot oil.
They're really good. That recipe came from my friend, Kira.
Yes.
She makes it all the time.
And I've now seen it in several places, as this cool new trick. So I thought, by throwing some cornstarch, some potato starch on the fries before putting them in, and it was really good.
It was.
You got to be careful because they'll really stick together. You really got to stir them good.
Right.
They do want to stick together. And then you put some on, some oven potatoes?
Yeah, I made some oven fries. And I've been trying to sort of tweak the oven fries a little bit because we get tired of just the same spice mix every time. So I've been trying different spice mixes. I really like the lemon and oregano flavors, but the lemon juice tends to kind of make them soggy. Mm. So I thought, well, what if I counteract the soggy with some potato starch?
Right.
And they were really good. Now they kind of did get stuck a little bit. The potato starch did kind of glue them to the baking sheet. Fortunately, I used parchment paper.
Right. Put the parchment paper down under it.
Right. But the flavor was really awesome.
Really good.
So crunchy.
And if you like that crispy flavor with them, because otherwise to get that crunchiness you got to really overcook them, and
right,
then they get kind of dry and this is, they're still moist inside but crunchy on the outside. So try some potato starch on your fries. It's really good.
Yeah, we also used it for the beef stew that we made this week.
That's
potato,
right,
starch.
Yes, to thicken up. And the beef stew is really good. Again, we've talked about our differing views on whether beef stew should be more potatoy or brown, or tomato or brown floury, I guess, although we're not using flour. But that came out really good. So recommend the potato starch on that. But you made a blueberry coffee cake today.
I did. I been wanted to make pancakes, but
after mass,
we thought that we were going to do the scout thing, and then we ended up not doing because it was way too cold.
And he wasn't feeling good.
And he wasn't feeling great. But I was sitting there on the way home from church. I was thinking, what can we do instead of pancakes It would be kind of a nice Sunday sweet treat.
And quick, right?
And quick. Well, it didn't turn out to be very quick, but it was definitely tasty.
Yeah.
So I was thinking coffee cake, and when I was looking at recipes, I found one for blueberry coffee cake, and I thought, ooh, I love the blueberry lemon flavor. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what we had were frozen blueberries, and they were not like the little frozen blueberries, like the little main ones, which I often get if I can find them, like the wild blueberries. These were big honkin',
big fat
gigantic fat blueberries.
Jersey blueberries.
Yeah. which are really nice. But the recipe that I was using was calling for fresh blueberries. So, and these were frozen. So I think, and there were like 2 cups of them in this coffee cake. There was a lot of blueberries, which is a lot of cold. And so it took at least 15, 20 minutes longer than the recipe was written for.
Because it was like 45 minutes to
it was like
50.
It was like 40 to 50 minutes.
Right.
And I must have put it in like by 5 minute increments, like another 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So it took a long time, and I covered it with foil because I was worried that my streusel topping was getting a little bit too dark.
Right.
But it tasted really good when it was finally cooked.
The bottom, like the sides and bottom, were a little dark. A little dark. Yeah. But the it tasted really awesome. It was really good.
We all had a huge slice when it was still hot from the oven.
And then we had it for dessert and ice cream.
And then we had some vanilla ice cream left over. But there was like only enough ice cream for each person to have a little scoop.
Yes.
And Bella said, well, why don't we just like, there was only 3 pieces of the coffee cake left, but they were big pieces. So everybody got half a piece of coffee cake and 1 little scoop of vanilla ice cream. And that was perfect.
Yeah, it was perfect. It was just enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a really good. Where'd you get the blueberry coffee cake recipe from?
Oh, I just Googled.
Okay.
I don't even remember. I could find it again in my Google history, but.
But you probably modified it anyway from the.
No, I actually followed it just as written.
All right. So
other than the frozen blueberries.
If you can find the link, I'll put it in the show notes. So let's move quickly to what we've been reading and watching. I'll mention 2 things that I've watched. I'm still working on my book. I've decided I've been too lackadaisical in reading it. I've only been reading it at bedtime. And this book is going to requires me to buckle down for a half hour every day and just like sit somewhere, take a break and read for a half hour, because it's a really good book. But it's just a long book. I can't wait to talk about it because, man, it's things like mental health, things like philosophical things, theological things. It's really, really awesome. This is The Stormlight Archive by Brandon Sanderson. Really awesome series. Anyway, but let me talk about the things I've actually. Did you want to say something?
I was just going to say another friend recommended it to me this week.
Oh, yeah.
But
you should totally read it because you'll really like it.
But they also said that he hasn't actually finished the series.
Well, no. So this is the end of the first major part.
Uh huh.
This is going to be a complete section. That there will be more that takes place in the same world, but will be at a different time period.
Okay.
So this is a complete story.
Okay. I am very wary of committing to big series which aren't finished. Like I'm stuck in the Dresden Files because I've committed to it.
Right.
I'm there. We're 17 books in. I'm in for the long haul.
Well,
but I don't necessarily want a lot of series out there that I'm like in the middle of.
So Sanderson writes all of his books within a overarching realm called the Cosmere. That's his. It's a multiverse.
His multiverse.
Okay. Where they intersect, and characters from one part of the Cosmere will sometimes show up in other parts.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah, so that's what that is about. So, but that's not what I'm talking about. So I watched two things this week that I want to talk about. First was a new Netflix movie called Outside the Wire, starring Anthony Mackie, who you probably don't recognize the name if you do, but he played Falcon in the Marvel movies, in the Avengers and Captain America movies, which you
haven't seen yet.
No. So, because he first shows up in Winter Soldier, which you haven't seen.
I haven't seen.
Really good. I like him as an actor. But Outside the Wire, takes place in, like, it says, I think 2030, so about 10 years from now. And it's about this Eastern Europe civil war. The U.S. is there as peacekeepers in the midst of this. It's sort of like what if Afghanistan was in the Eastern Europe? That's basically what it is. And so we have this drone pilot who has to be sent into the war zone because he messes up. He's too detached from the effects of war as a drone pilot sitting in Peach Air Force Base outside of Las Vegas instead of being in the war zone. So he gets sent to the war zone, and then it becomes this whole big story about technology, AI, and the cost of war. And it kind of ends up a lot like a lot of these movies do, which is about an AI that could decide that the solution to war is to eliminate the humans, sort of thing.
Sort of a Skynet.
Right. But it's not exactly that, because it's more about showing the true cost of, you know, what human beings need to do, which was the whole point of the drone pilot going there, is the people who are making war from a distance need to experience
war.
They need to know what it is, and so that they will stop doing it. And there's the humanity in how much humanity can an AI have, and so there's some of that stuff. It was okay. It wasn't like fantastic. If it were in the theaters, I don't know that I would have gone to it. But if you want to watch it on Netflix, you know, it's there, and it was pretty good. If you like an action movie,
so it was sort of philosophical, but mostly an action movie.
Yeah. Yeah, there was, and it wasn't like, it wasn't over the top, like heavy handed in its messaging, but there was a bit of a philosophical element to it. But there was a lot of action. I'm trying to think. It was somewhat unrealistic in that there were there's some technology that there's no way, like, we're not going to have autonomous. Like the Boston Dynamics robots, the guy, the man shaped ones, as weapon carrying
soldiers,
not by 2030. Like, there was a little bit that was like, you probably should have said this a little further into the future. But nevertheless, yeah, it was okay. So the other thing I was watching is on BritBox, which is I mentioned before, it's a streaming service that carries exclusively British television. Off of BBC and ITV and, you know, so the various British networks, and they also make original content. And one of their original series that I found is a show called Wild Bill, starring Rob Lowe as an American police chief who gets hired to be the chief constable in Boston, England, in Lincolnshire.
Boston, England.
Yes, the original Boston. And
interesting.
He's not a street cop. He's an analytical cop. He's all about the algorithm and using information and data and technology to fight crime. And Lincolnshire and Boston in particular have like the worst crime in England. Like, apparently, even worse than all the other places where people get murdered in little English villages and all the other series. Worse than the Shetlands, apparently. It's classic fish out of water. It's very interesting to see an American, like, how they perceive the American cop from a British point of view. Like, he's the American from a British point of view.
Right.
He's a single dad. He's a widower with a 14-year-old daughter. And the supporting cast is really good. There's this young detective, but they call it PC or not PC. Detective Inspector?
D.I. Like D.I. Hardy?
Yes. D.I. Yardley, and she's this local, she's from the area, she's a local woman, a farm family, so the Lincolnshire is all farms, right. It's a very rural area, and she comes from a farm family, she's very much farm stock, and like she's big boned, like she's a big girl, she's a big woman, you know, I mean, she's not slight, she's not the classic, you know, movie star looks.
I feel like British TV is a lot more willing to cast a broader range of physical types, body types,
yes,
than American, and a lot broader range of ages too.
Yes, they're less obsessed with
looks and prettiness
and youth.
Yeah. And slimness.
Well, and in fact, it comes up at one point because he's like, you know, he says something sort of brash like an American would. And she says, I'm not fat. I'm farm stock. Like, this is like hard earned. And she like grabs like a roll on her belly. She's like, well, I earned this from working on the farm with my brothers and my dad. And, you know, so it was, and she's really awesome. She's like in her 20s, but she's a really kind of cool cop. And there's some really, it's actually been pretty good. I really enjoy it. It's only about 5 or 6 episodes, like a British series is, but it's episodic. It's got a through line in it, but it's episodic. And so I would recommend it. Wild Bill. It's kind of fun. Bill. Yeah. All right, you had something that you finished. You didn't really do much watching this week.
I didn't know watching because I was working on finishing my talk. I mean, it was done, but it wasn't done. Like
edited. Yes,
I had the outline like a month ago, but it took me forever to actually make myself sit down and do the editing work. But yeah, I finished my Russian novel Laurus week.
You talked about it last week.
I really, really, really liked this novel, and I highly recommend it. It's interesting because it's very much a novel about faith,
mm-hmm.
and it takes faith seriously. Like, I do not feel at all that it mocks or belittles or holds faith at a distance. Like, it really, the novel has a very medieval understanding of faith. Like, it sees everything from that immersion in a world which is just faith is the bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very, and it has this very cyclical understanding of time, which is very medieval as well. And so the main character, his name at the end at his death is Laurus, but at the beginning it's Arseny, and in the middle he's called a couple other names. He goes through four names, and it's almost like each of his four stages of his life is almost, he's like a different person. And yet a lot of the same sort of themes, there's almost this feeling of he's the same person, but experiencing the same cyclical time.
Okay.
And then the novel is very modern in its sense of there are characters in the novel who have knowledge of the future all the way up until the 20th century. There's even a little segment of the novel which takes place like in 20th century Russia with an archaeologist who's excavating the church and convent where he spent some time.
Okay.
And there's this sort of anachronistic sense, but it's because this idea of time being something that human beings experience, but that's not what God experiences.
Right.
And therefore, we have this ability, especially the more connected we are to God, to experience time in a nonlinear fashion. And so
that sounds very wibbly wobbly.
It's very right. So there's one character, a secondary character who's very important, who's an Italian who has these visions of the future, but they're very sort of not like visions of super important things, but just like visions of
life in the future.
And there's the, you know, they have these glimpses of time, and there's this pondering about time. They're very obsessed. The Italian guy is very obsessed with the idea of the end of the world, that it's soon going to be 7,000 years from the creation of the world, and therefore the world is going to end because, you know, 7,000.
Right. Seven days,
7,000. So sort of this perfect idea of perfection. And yet, because he keeps having these glimpses of the far future, he's not 100% convinced that the world is really going to end.
Right.
But the main character ends his days in a place that's very, like, he's very elderly. He's a holy hermit. And yet he's within a couple of miles of where he was a child. And the experiences of his last few months, his last few years, are very much sort of a repetition of the events of his childhood and his young adulthood. And so he's kind of come full circle, but is in a different place. I loved it. It was such a good story. And it was so full of a hopefulness and a, but sort of a wonder too. I don't know. I, It's hard to put into words. It was very Russian.
Very Russian.
Yeah. And I loved the translator's notes. One of the things that the author does in the original Russian is he uses a lot of different Russian dialects, like Old Slavonic and quotes from the Bible in Old Slavonic, which is the Russian equivalent of like Church Latin mm-hmm. for us right. in the Western Church.
So how does the translator handle that?
So she handles it with a sort of Chaucerian English. It's not exactly Chaucerian. It's sort of pseudo Chaucerian, but it looks old and feels old.
Right.
But there's the text is interesting because it has these juxtapositions where there will be like this old English quotation from the Bible or people speaking in this very old English. And then in the next sentence, the next line will be somebody speaking in very contemporary slang. Like, that's just your opinion, man. I mean, really jarring. And yet I think thematically it really works.
Hmm.
But that felt very it felt very modern because it kept pulling you into your modern consciousness. Like, it's not the American idea of a historical novel where everything in the novel looks and feels like it would to a person who lived in that time. Whereas because these characters exist in a way partly outside of time, there's this allowance for this 21st century point of view. The novel, I think, was published in 2008, 2012. It's a really recent novel.
Yeah.
And it was only translated in English in 2015. So, yeah,
cool.
I highly recommend. It's really gave me a lot to think about and ponder, and very faith-filled.
Excellent. Very good. Well, I think that about does it for us this time. We should wrap things up there. We do want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Father Stephen W., Walter G., Daniel W., Harry R., and Layla L. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. Now's a great time to become a StarQuest patron, thanks to a generous gift from a StarQuest supporter. When you start a new Patreon monthly pledge at sqpn.com/give, the first 3 months will be matched by an equal amount from our donor. So if you become a new patron at, say, $10 a month, after 3 months, our donor will give $30 to StarQuest to support all our shows, including this one, making your gift go even further. So if you've been thinking of becoming a StarQuest patron, now is the time. Visit sqpn.com/give today. And so if you have any feedback for us, anything you want to comment on from our discussion, you can let us know by going to sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And I'll put all the links from our discussion in our show notes on sqpn.com. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.